you're a guest with us, welcome. It's my privilege to serve as pastor here and to lead and love the North Central Church family. We are halfway through a series, a little more than halfway through a series today in Romans chapter 8. And we're going to read verses 14 to 16 together, and then here's some tremendous news that is described to us right here in the scriptures, and not just hear the news, but to get to walk through, what does that mean? What are the implications for us? Why is it good news? And we'll do that together. Romans chapter 8, verses 14 to 16, and it goes like this. Paul the Apostle is writing to the church at Rome, and he says, "For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. So you have not received a spirit that makes you fearful slaves. Instead, you received God's Spirit when he adopted you as his own children, and now we call him Abba, Father." When you believe, God does something. He sends his indwelling spirit. So God has this spirit of his own. It is fully God, and that spirit indwells us, and upon our faith, God regenerates us, and then new things happen. There are implications of that happening, which Paul diagnoses and documents here in Romans chapter 8. And what Paul is doing is he's saying that when you put your faith in Jesus, you are joined to Jesus, you are unified, you are found in union with Jesus, and when you're placed in Christ, you belong to God, and unbelievably supernatural things happen that are beyond what you can see. And when that happens, it erases the distinctions between races, classes, genders, and other performance-based or identity-based distinctions. The religious and the rebellious are brought together by their faith and become a family, surrounding one single conviction, and that is that Jesus is the solution to our separation from God and to the sin that separates us. Also, the Spirit is indwelling a believer and frees us. There's no more condemnation for the sin that separates us. No more condemnation that we deserve for our selfish sin. But the Spirit also fuels our obedience to love God more than we love anything that he's created. We don't make good things God things because God alone is the one who we love with our whole mind, heart, soul, and strength. But also the Spirit helps us to love others above loving ourselves. The Spirit also does a special work of fueling our obedience, fixing and focusing our mindset to let the Spirit cause us to overcome sin and obey God. What does that mean? That the Spirit brings a new love in us for the Father that helps us overcome sin and obey the Father because we care more about the gratification, satisfaction of loving and obeying the Father than we do sinning and selfishly indulging for ourselves. The Spirit also fills us with a sense of new life now, but also a sense of assurance that our bodies are going to be renewed as the resurrection power of God that raised Jesus from the dead is eventually going to upgrade, renew, and fully restore our bodies. How many of you are due for a restored new body? Anybody? The Spirit does that work. We don't leave our bodies. We don't separate from our bodies. The soul doesn't float and spend eternity ghostly hopping around from one little cloud to the next cloud playing a harp in baby diapers. We get a new body. We start with the restorative work of God back to the original plan. How does that happen? By the work of the Spirit. The Spirit is also in us, freeing us from any obligation to slavishly follow our sinful urges and desires. We now get a choice. How do we get a choice? Because the Spirit is constantly saying, choose the Father. Choose to please the Father. Choose life instead of continuing to chase and your urges. Now, if you could imagine with me today that you are the newest winner of the Powerball lottery. I'm not talking scratch off 30 bucks. I'm talking you won the Powerball lottery, and that lottery was so big, you've got to disappear into anonymity. You can't let people know that you won because they would use and abuse you, and so you won this unbelievable fortune. And if you can't get yourself to imagine gambling a little bit, imagine you inherited some huge fortune and estate. How many of you know, I mean, you've been imagining, some of you know exactly what that would do for you, but can you even imagine how your life would change? You no longer have to borrow anything, you just buy it. tremendous amount of freedom that it may give you. Although if you read the stories of the lives of lottery winners, have you noticed, have you ever read them? They hit the skids pretty quick. How many of you are willing to risk it? Anyone willing to risk it with me? Today, what you're going to hear is more life-altering, more transformational, it's more life-changing than winning the lottery or discovering that you have an inheritance coming. We have this phrase that we use in our church body, it's what we envision, that the good news of the gospel is so life-altering that it's transformative, it changes. Now, so here's our big idea today, that when you received God's Spirit, it completely transformed the way you approach Him. And I want you to key on the word transform, because when we say gospel transformation, we don't simply only mean that God no longer counts your sins against you. We don't only mean that Jesus saved you because He died the death that you were supposed to die in His place and He lived the life you were supposed to live. All of that is beautiful good news and it brings freedom and it brings... We also believe that the transformation has to do with the what changed as it relates to how we are now able to approach God who created and sustained every single piece of matter, cell, atom, nucleus on the planet. And He sustains it all. But by the power of the Spirit, He has made it possible for you to approach Him. And guess what? Everything changes based on that. I'd love to win the lottery. It's hard to win the lottery when you don't play the lottery, but I'm believing for a miracle. Don't doubt. Love to enjoy an inheritance. The greatest wealth that exists on the planet for you and I, you know what it is? Contentment. Just contentment. And let me tell you this. What Paul is going to describe to the church at Rome today is something that we could be content over. That we now, based on the grace of God and the Spirit at work in us, have everything we need to approach God who created the universe. Recently, someone told me, Pastor Dan, when you send me text messages about, hey, can we get together? I got to be honest with you. I start to sweat. I get so nervous, anxious, tense. The last time you did it, I was nauseous for hours. And I said to my wife, do you not want me to text you anymore then when I send you a text message? I mean, I think I get the hint. So they describe this nervousness, and they explain to me, and I've heard it a couple times since, that, well, I don't even know what it's about. I don't know if I'm in trouble. I don't know if I'm being demoted. I don't know if I'm being confronted. I don't know if I'm being corrected. Did I do something wrong? Did I fail? Otherwise, maybe you just want to meet with me because we've met together before. Other people have smartened up, and they follow up that kind of text to me with, am I in trouble? And if not, then yes, I accept. We can meet. Let's just get it out of the way. And I understand what's happening because I believe this is true for most of us. We tend to move toward people who accept us, but when there's any doubt that they accept us, we've let them down, we failed them. We didn't perform, they're upset with us. Would you agree with me that we tend to shy away from those people? We tend to pull off and pull away. I mean, when you and I get a performance review at work, speaking of so highly of our performance, speaking so kindly and brightly about what we're contributing to the company and how well-loved and liked we are, most of us respond by wanting to spend more time at work, more time with our coworkers, and we start inviting our boss to our children's birthday parties and graduation parties. But when that bad performance review comes harshly across the table, I think it probably is true for many of us, we start to kind of cave in on the inside and withdraw because we've failed and people are starting to make the observation that we're not performing well. And for most of us, that generates some kind of disconnect and we start looking for ways to go the long way around people that we've disappointed or that we've let down. I mean, some people, this has affected their marriage and their family for years. Their parents who are estranged from their children because they have realized that one or the other or both have let the other down, and there's a performance failure, and there's a disconnect, and they don't relate to each other very often, and when they do, it's distant, cold, and tense, and the reason is because they're not quite sure of their standing with the other, and there's a sense of risk, and there's a sense of judgment, and there's a sense of distance based on the fact that they're not really sure that they've been received. They sense the rejection, and they stay away, and some of this goes on for years and years and years. I believe the same is true in the way that relate to the Father in heaven, God. I believe that for the moments in which you and I perceive that we're not living up to God's expectations, that we're not performing the way He's expecting us to, that we have a faith that starts to become stressful and tense and distant and cold and dry and intermittent, mostly cold and not quite hot. And the reason is because we're not quite sure God is willing or even able in His perfection to receive us when we're failing and we're not performing or we're erratic. I hear people say this to me all the time, "Pastor, you haven't seen me in a while. You know, I'm not feeling like I'm really doing that well in my Christian faith. And you know, and I don't want to just show up on Sunday and pretend like everything's great." And so what happens? Withdraw, because the performance isn't, not really doing my part. And so today, if you can get this, if you can believe this, if this settles into your heart, if this takes root, here's going to be the fruit of this. The fruit of this is this. There will be change in the way that you see your standing with God, and it's going to change the way you approach God forever. Can you imagine seeing and serving God peacefully, having a sense of joy, gratitude, and a sense of rest, no matter how you're doing, no matter how the world's doing, no matter how you're feeling, no matter what somebody says to you, no matter how disconnected and rejected you feel by people, there's some sense of rest, joy, and gratitude in your relationship with God. And to receive what we need, we have to learn how to approach God. You know what? The author of Hebrews says it this way: let us come boldly to the throne of God. We have an ability, based on God's grace, to approach God's throne with boldness. Not recklessly, not irreverently, but we come with boldness. Boldness. And when we do, here's what we discover. God gives us what we need. We get the grace we need. We get the mercy we need. Here's what I want to ask you to consider today. Consider today that we can always go boldly before God because of what He's done to transform our standing with Himself. This is better than winning the lottery. This is better news than going to see Oprah and absolutely losing your mind over reaching under your seat and pulling off a key to your new car. You got to pay taxes on that anyway. But people lose their mind over that because something great happened to them. Something great has happened to us that puts to shame the material gain of the lottery and inheritance and the Oprah show. Let's talk about what that is. We're going to look deeply at what that is, and it starts with this. It's one big truth. It changes everything. It's transformational, and here it is. When you receive God's Spirit, He makes you. He does the work to make you His own adopted child. Adoption. Adoption. He adopts you. He makes you. He based on your faith, you are joined with Christ. You are in union with Jesus, and when that happens, there is some instinctive and gracious benefits that come along. For all who are led by the Spirit of God are children of God. You receive God's Spirit when He adopted you as His own child. In Galatians, Paul writes it this way: for you are all children of God. How? Through faith in Christ Jesus. John writes it this way in 1 John 3:1. See how very much our Father loves us, for He calls us His children, and that is what we are. But the people who belong to this world don't recognize that we are God's children because they don't know Him. And here John makes a distinction between the people that know God and are His children and those who don't know God, and they don't recognize us because they don't belong to God themselves. And being a Christian is a privilege, and we need to appreciate divine adoption. The magnitude of Paul's statement here is summarized by or is analyzed by a theologian named Sinclair Ferguson. And here's what he says. The notion, the idea that we are children of God has his own sons and daughters is the mainspring of Christian living. Get this, the mainspring. The mainstream of Christian living is the awareness that we belong to God as his child. This truth is not a sprinkler that's dripping on us occasionally in different seasons of our life. This is the mainspring providing life and freshness to us, is the awareness and the belief and the confidence that indeed God has made us his own child. And that is something that, again, changes everything. What does divine adoption mean? Paul was writing this, and you would have Hebrew readers and you would have Roman readers. As a citizen of Rome, Paul knew what he was saying. He was primarily identifying with the Romans who understand what adoption means. What adoption means to the Romans who are reading this is this, that normally that there is a parent who is wealthy and doesn't have an heir. They don't have an heir. Can you imagine you have all this wealth and you have no one to give it away to? So what they would do is they would adopt a child, a young person, or an adult, and they would legally make a transaction, and in this legal transaction, they would adopt the child and make them their own, and instantly that child would become legally entitled to all of that parent's wealth. Some other things happened too when that adoption happened that I think is worth pointing out. All the old debts and legal obligations of the child were paid in full. How many of you want to get adopted? I'm like, please God send an adopter and the Powerball. Inheritance. Also, the adopted child got a new name. Was instantly an heir of all the father had. His father became instantly liable for all the child's actions, all their debt. If they were charged with a criminal, some kind of crime, the criminal past became the obligation of the new father. The new son also had new obligations. The only obligations the new child had, listen to this, the only obligations they had to the parent was to honor the parent, was to please the father. All this is in behind this passage here when we're talking about being adopted. How many of you heard people say, I mean, sometimes we hear this in the our celebrity culture will write songs and they'll write movies and they'll write screenplays or they'll have some good public service announcement and they'll say something like, I mean, after all, we're all God's children. It's so heartwarming. Aren't we all God's children? Come on, let's just put our differences aside. Can't we all get along? What the world needs is love. Just do it. You deserve a break today. I mean, come on. I'm loving it. Here's what Paul's saying. Paul is saying that while all the human race is a descendant of God, has our origin in God, to say that we're all God's children is accurate in that God is the origin and the source. No different than saying that it's Henry Ford who's the father of the automobile. But to describe human beings as children means specifically that some have been brought near to God by adoption based on their faith and a work of the Spirit, but not everybody. And what that also means is that we are born in that little hospital room, God willing it was a hospital room, not a field or a car, but we're born into the world, that we're born into separation. We're born into the world as orphans. We are disconnected and we are shut out, separated by a wall of hostility in our own sinful flesh, the seed of Adam that we're inherited. And we are at some point, all of us start our lives disconnected and distant from the Father who created us. And this also means that there was a time when we were lost. We're not naturally God's children. The image of adoption tells us that our relationship with God is based entirely on a legal act of the Father. By the way, isn't it true that adopted children, when they were a candidate for adoption, they didn't go search the world for a parent? The parent does the searching. The parent makes the legal transaction. The parent spends the time, and the parent spends the money. The parent does the legal work. The parent actually makes the investment. It costs the parent. They invest everything and the child receives everything. That's what the implications are here for adoption. It's a legal act on the part of the father. It's very costly only for the parent, and there is nothing the son does to win or earn the status that's simply received. They go from slave and orphan to child. Scriptures call it sonship. They're made sons. And that sonship is given to those who receive him. No one has it naturally except for Jesus. So here's three privileges. What are the implications of that? What does that mean? What does that mean for us on the daily grind of life? Here are three implications, three privileges when God is your Father, when by your faith you are joined with Jesus, regenerated, and adopted by the Father, you receive special privileges. Special privileges. You get a divine VIP pass backstage, so to speak. You get special privilege. When you approach God's presence, he allows you to blow past the line of people that are being held up. And when you show him your child status, everybody gets asked to move aside and he ushers you in where? To the throne of the creator of the universe who sustains all things. And you get a special audience with the headline, the king, with the ruler of all things, and we enjoy this privilege. And here's how it's represented. Paul says this: now, because we're adopted, we get to call the God of the universe Abba Father. If you've been around the church long enough, you know that word Abba Father has some implications to it. It means intimacy, it means closeness, it means privacy, it means you get to enjoy something unique. And specifically what that means is a breathtaking privilege where we get to enjoy our status. You've got that in your notes. We get to. Everybody say we get to. We get to. We get to. What does that mean? It means privilege. We get to. We have the honor of. By God's grace, we are allowed to do what? To enjoy our new status. You went from mid-size rental car to God upgraded you to the luxury brand. I resent all of you who's ever had that happen. I only ever get, sorry, we don't have your car, Mr. Williams. Sorry. Do you know how to drive tricycles? That's how it feels. You get this massive status upgrade from coach class in the airline where you sit like this. When these are the few hours a year, I thank God that he's made me petite. So I don't, and I look at these giants near me and start to pray for them and say, how can they ever unfold from this position once they get out of here? Their bones are grinding together, sitting. And imagine, God has, in a universal way, in a life-changing way, he's upgraded you from coach to first class. And there's newness there. You have a new status. You get to snap your fingers at people. Tell them you want stuff and hope they don't drag you off the plane. I want whatever everyone's having. Bring it to me. How much is it? Oh, it's free. You have a new status. It's backstage. You get to meet with and pray with the world-class entertainment act. You get an upgrade in your status. Similar. Now, this is something that it's contrasted to being a slave. A slave doesn't have status and authority. A slave is obligated. A slave has responsibilities only. The slave, in fact, has no authority. They can only do what they are told, and everything they have to earn. Now, the contrasting position here is that of a child. And isn't it true that our children in our homes have authority that our employees and slaves don't have? Anybody have a child who knows where the refrigerator is in the house? Pulls the door open and commands to everybody that we need someone to go grocery shop and fill this fridge because it's empty. My kids occasionally have found a bigger, more comfortable bed called the master bedroom, and they found our bed. Feet on the pillows, full authority that's exercised in my home because, why? Because they are children. Illustrated in no clearer way than our kids. How many of you have your kids sit at the dinner table? They're not in the doghouse, right? You don't have your, sometimes you let the kids, and if they're good, they can eat, but they're here they are at the table. Joining you at the table. Why? Because they have new status, new authority in their relationship to you as the child. Children of God are given new authority over sin, death, and the grave, and no longer have to fear or otherwise cower themselves down because they've been given a new status with full authority. They can move about in the world knowing that it belongs, the whole creation belongs to their Father. Sometimes people have noticed that pastor's kids can sometimes have the run of the place and they look like they own the place, and I have an explanation for that. It probably has to do with how often, how long the children of pastors are in the building, but it also has to do with the sense of confidence that a child has that, do you know who my dad is? You know who my father is? He kind of owns the place. And if he owns the place, guess who else owns the place? So we own the place. And that happens. It is instinctive to a child to walk around the place and feel that if it belongs to the father, it's also theirs too. And there's a confidence and a poise, not an arrogance and a self-righteousness, but there's a confidence and a poise with our new status. I follow the Twitter feed from NASA. And the reason I do that is because there are some Christians in NASA who tweet from a Christian worldview, and they point out things that are inexplicable by science. Inexplicable. Cannot be explained why 300 million plus galaxies exist and are moving away from the sun, from each other at mind-boggling speeds. And you know what? Every now and then I think, that's my dad. It belongs to the Father. It blows my mind that it belongs to my Father, that he knows where every one of those stars is. He knows every single galaxy and how it's twisting and turning and where it's headed and how it got there and where it started. With your new status as a child, we have the honor of his name. New status that's conferred on us. Secondly, we get to express our closeness. We get to not only see our Father as owning all of those things from a distance, but we get to approach the Father in new closeness and intimacy. When he adopted us, he gave us a spirit. We received a spirit not of a fearful slave, but we received the spirit when he adopted us as his own children. Do you remember when Jesus was teaching his disciples to pray? Do you know how specifically Jesus said, here's how you pray. Here's where you start. Our Father. Why do you think Jesus did that? I don't know why Jesus did that. Can I assume some things? One of the things I assume is that Jesus wants us to remember that when we approach the Father, we're not approaching from a distance. We're approaching the Father by our faith, and we're approaching him with intimacy and closeness. And when you start your prayer, I would recommend for those of you who have the habit of starting your prayers, dear Lord, nothing wrong with that, that you begin the way Jesus teaches us to pray, our Father. And by doing so, you're saying, Daddy, my, whatever you call, whatever your term of endearment is, I hear all kinds of them. Dad, Papa, Poppy. My kids call me Moneybags, whatever your term of endearment is. Whatever it is, our Father who is in heaven but allows me by intimate, by closeness has conferred upon me this new intimacy where I'm able to pray with the greatest intimacy, new confidence, new closeness. So here's the problem. Most of you and I have two approaches in which we kind of approach the Father, and this is critical. We have to see this. There is a spirit of slavery and there's a spirit of sonship, and most of us wobble between both of them, and if we do bad, we approach like a slave, and if we do good, we're pretty confident like a child. Here's what Paul is teaching us. There is one way to approach the Father. It's with the spirit of a child. Well, what does that look like? How do I know the difference? Isn't it true that I'm always approaching as a child? Probably not. Look here at your notes and you'll see this. We approach God like a slave, with the spirit of a fearful slave, every time we approach God based on our performance, based on whether we're having a good day or a bad day, based on whether we're having a good week or a bad week, based on whether we believe God is pleased with us or he's unhappy with us. When we allow that to be the conditions in which we approach God or don't approach God, we are demonstrating that we are being influenced and subject to this attitude or this spirit of fearful slavery. where the presence that I have with God, the approach that I have with God is based on whether or not he's pleased with me and if I'm having a good, I hear people regularly say something to me like, Pastor, I haven't seen you on Sundays for a while, I haven't really been there, I'm having a tough phase, just really grinding it out, my faith is really, kind of struggling now, and I don't want to go and show up at church and just pretend like everything's great and withdraw when things are bad, press in when things are good. There's a spirit of slavery which says, if you want an audience with God, it's got to be based on your good performance. And the accuser's always there telling us, you're not performing. God will never receive you. And by the way, when you appear on Sundays among your church family, everyone knows you're a phony. Everyone knows that you are Mr. and Miss Spiritual, and you sign up for stuff, and you're waving your hands around, and sometimes you think, oh, if I just sway a little bit while we're singing, they're going to think I'm really having a dynamo week, and maybe you can just catch the pastor, catch a little glimpse out of the corner of your eye, and think, oh, there must be really doing good. So, and the rest of us say, I don't want to fake it. It's the spirit of a fearful slave. When it's time every day to approach the Father, when you take that position in your knees and you bow your heart to the Father and you open the scriptures to hear what he's saying to you, God forbid we think that we have earned that audience with the Father based on our performance. God forbid we don't take that position on our knees and open those scriptures and start to interact with the Father in heaven because we believe we failed him and our performance isn't good enough. There's another spirit at work in us that is helping us to approach the Father, and it's based on privilege. Where does this privilege come from? It comes from the grace of the Father giving us his spirit. Where does that spirit come from? When we're having a good week, we get a new spirit, a new skip in our step? Absolutely not. It comes at the moment that you are regenerated and he fills you with his spirit, he now gives you privilege that you don't deserve. And in that privilege, we get to experience approaching the Father, not characterized, a spirit not characterized by the fear of losing relationship. We're not afraid that if we're doing bad, he's going to fire us or he's going to demote us or he's going to criticize us. It causes a sense of gratitude and confidence. And here's the thing. It's possible to start with the spirit of a child and then to return to the spirit of the slave. Jesus taught about this and he said there's two sons. One is an older son who's slavishly obedient, but there's a rebellious son. And the rebellious son, some of you remember the story. Jesus tells it about the rebellious son who stands up in front of the father and says, I renounce my inheritance. I no longer want the family name. I'm going to dishonor you, but by dishonoring you, I know I'm going to receive my inheritance. I'm going to separate myself from the family. And he ends up in the pig pen. And in the pig pen, he says things like this. I'm a fool. What am I doing? What am I doing here? How did I end up in this? Even my father's what? Servants have a better life than this. And then he has an idea. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to approach my father, and I'm going to beg him to take me back, and I'm going to promise that I'm going to serve him like a servant. I'll be his slave if he just gives me a wage, just a small little wage that I can live on. I'll take up residence in the outhouse, the doghouse, the mother-in-law apartment, the shed. I'll live somewhere else. It doesn't matter. If he just pays me a little wage based on my performance. In the heart of the Father, Jesus says, uh-uh. No. It's not how it's going to work. Here's how it's going to work. You're my son. Yeah, but I embarrassed you. I disrespected the family name. I renounced my inheritance. I dishonored you among everywhere, and I have completely, whoa. Don't ever forget something. No matter what you've done, you are still my child. And when you are my child, no matter how you've performed, no matter how much dishonor you've brought to the family name, here's what we do. Bring the ring. Bring the robe. Bring the royalty. We're going to celebrate because my child was dead, but now my child is what? Alive again. What's it based on? The grace of the Father. What's it based on? The unconditional care, fatherly care of the parent. And God is saying, if you're my child, that changes everything. No more spirit of fearful slavery. No more earning it from God. No more fear of being fired, demoted, or reprimanded. Instead, a child of God, even with human parents, we say things like, I know she's been so terrible and had such struggles and hurt us so bad, but she's still my daughter. Have you ever heard somebody say that before? What am I supposed to do? We just keep loving them. They're ruining their lives. We keep loving them because they're still my child. It's the same way God. I mean, where do you think you got that instinct from? That instinct comes from the Father. Even after all you've done, you're still my child. And by God's grace and by the work of his Spirit, we now get to rest in this. This brings confidence to us. You have it in your notes. We get the privilege to rest in our confidence. We have a new assurance, for his Spirit joins with our spirit and whispers to us, you belong to the Father. And God's Spirit affirms with our spirit that we indeed are God's children. Now, Paul is responding to the question here, how do we know this is true? How can we be sure this is true? Because I don't know about you, but I tend to focus on my limitations, my failures, my flaws, and my poor performances. Anybody else like that? I keep track of why I ought not to be rewarded by God in any way, shape, or form. And yet what God is showing us here is that he has an indwelling spirit at work in us, and it reminds us that these truths are indeed true. Imagine it this way. Imagine there's a defendant who's on trial. There's some evidence that the defendant is guilty. There's some evidence of that the defendant is innocent. And the jury is going back and forth. They could be innocent. They could be guilty. And the defendant is trying to say, I wasn't even there at the scene of the crime. I wasn't there. And sure enough, just before a decision is made, the defense says, I want to offer one last witness. And this witness with authority stands and addresses the jury and says, I was there. The defendant was not. I can name everyone who was there, the scene of the crime, and I can list them by name. I know what they look like. I know who they are. And I can assure you that the defendant was not there. This witness ends the case. This witness removes any doubt. This witness affirms the testimony of the defendant, and this witness finally brings the case to the end. It's closed. And the judge declares, we have a witness that they're innocent. The Spirit of God sides with our spirit to plead that indeed we are a child of God. The witness of the Spirit settles the case, whether we're a fearful slave or a child of God. The Spirit of God settles the case and whispers affirmation to our heart slowly and quietly. And this is so important. This is why you and I on a routine basis have to get alone, have to unplug, and have to get quiet, because the Spirit just whispers gently to us, you belong to the Father. You belong to the Father. I know when you look around, you feel like you're being punished, that your performance is being rewarded with discipline and what have you. But we have to put ourselves in a position to hear the Spirit telling us, testifying to us. The love that comes across by God's Spirit to his child is something that Paul's trying to get across. It's a sense. It may not be a very strong feeling. There'll be at times when we cry out to Abba, we find ourselves deeply assured that indeed by the Spirit, you belong to the Father. You're a child of his. What does that mean? Rings and robes, privilege, access, intimacy, rest, closeness, new status and authority. Listen, it changes everything when you are able to decide once and for all, God, in God's home, there is no doghouse. Nobody lives there. It's always the best accommodations, always the best, that it is indeed the Spirit's work testifying for us and to us that we truly are the sons of the living God. You know what? One of the things that I think is the way that God has worked this is this. I'm not sure God believed that you and I would always be able to remind ourselves of this. So he said, here's what you're going to do. On a regular basis, when you gather, break bread, receive the cup, and let it remind you that I didn't just pay a little time. Have you ever heard the stories about adoption being so costly? Time and energy is one thing, but also financial cost. And here's what God has done. Through the exhortation of Jesus, when you get together, never forget that the Father has paid more than money. It cost him more than it did than it costs you financially to adopt. It cost him the blood of his innocent child, and it pleased him to crush him because that was the cost of adoption. And then he said this, do this until I return. Remember this until I return. And so I wonder today, as we observe communion together and remember, I'm confident that the Spirit would be at work reminding you, it's you. You belong to the Father. You're one of his children. Our ushers are coming now to pass out the elements. If you're familiar with the gospel and you understand the symbols, we encourage you, no matter where you're from, that you receive it with us. But if you're not, let it pass by until you're fully aware of the gospel, the good news, the implication and symbolism of each of these elements. In the meantime, we're going to sing together and listen for the Spirit testifying in your heart that indeed, based on your faith and the grace of the Father, you belong to him as his child. Let's sing together.